Hi, it's Elise Lunan, host of Pulling the Thread. I'm thrilled to welcome today's guest, science writer Florence Williams, whose stunning book, Heartbreak, A Personal and Scientific Journey, is the focus of today's conversation. I woke up at 2 a.m. last night drenched in sweat, throwing bedding off of me. Every pet was also on top of me, which probably didn't help. Many nights, I have the opposite problem, where I'm hunting in the hall closet for extra blankets in the wee hours because I'm freezing. In part, this is because my husband and I have wildly different sleep temperature preferences, and I'm cold because he's left all the sliding doors in our house wide open. But there's actually a solution I've come to learn, and I'm all about a sleep solution because we know how important good, uninterrupted sleep is for every facet of health. Have you heard about ChiliPad by SleepMe? It's a bed cooling system designed to revolutionize the way you sleep naturally. The ChiliPad bed cooling system is your new bedtime solution. It lets you customize your sleeping environment to your optimal temperature, ensuring you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up refreshed. ChiliPad works with your existing mattress. It's a water-based mattress topper that continuously controls your bed temperature from 55 to 115 degrees. You can also choose a different setting than your partner, so you each get what you need. What I want? A cool mattress with piles of blankets on top. ChiliPad believes sleeping at the optimal temperature helps people naturally reach their highest potential physically and mentally. Visit www.sleep.me/thread. to get your Chili Pad and save up to $315 with code THREAD. This offer is available exclusively for Pulling the Thread listeners and only for a limited time. Order it today with free shipping and try it out for 30 days. You can return it for free if you don't like it with their sleep trial. Visit www.sleep.me/thread. Because you're not just investing in better sleep, you're creating a better life. Hi, it's Elise Lunan, host of Pulling the Thread. On this show, we pull apart the web in which we all live to understand who we are and why we're here. Pulling the Thread is about big questions. Why we do what we do, how we can understand our own experiences within a larger spiritual and historical context, the ways in which we might begin to understand ourselves and each other better, and what's required to heal ourselves and our world. I'll be joined in conversation by luminaries and wise elders, those who have laid tracks in their work and lives to help us bring meaning and understanding to a world that often feels chaotic and overwhelming. My hope is that these conversations spark moments of resonance and plant tiny seeds of awareness so that we might all collectively learn and grow.
It's okay to not be perfect. I don't want to be judging myself for my imperfections. I actually want to be accepting myself for my imperfections. And that is really liberating, actually. You know, I think so many women, we grow up thinking we are supposed to be perfect. And we internalize, you know, excelling at everything and being good at everything and, you know, curating our appearance and, you know, being the perfect mom and doing everything right and doing everything right and doing everything right. And just the realization that I was like so over that and feeling like it was actually getting in the way of my having a more authentic understanding of who I was. That's when I think a corner really started to be turned.
So says Florence Williams, the author of The Nature Fix and Heartbreak, A Personal and Scientific Journey, which is a beautiful exploration of the end of her marriage and its impact on her health and her soul. Florence met her husband in college and had never lived alone, much less alone as a middle-aged woman. Their divorce and her corresponding heartbreak turned her upside down and filled her with incapacitating amounts of anxiety and fear. The resulting memoir offers a map as she returns to herself. Ever the science writer, though, this isn't just a treatise on her feelings of rejection and loss. This is also a thoroughly researched guide to the implications of heartbreak on our hearts, full of learnings for all of us. Okay, let's get to our conversation. I loved Heartbreak. I am watching this tendency in myself to only commend, not only commend, but I love memoirs that are structured in a way that support these bigger conversations. And I'm only watching it in myself because I feel like there's like this feminine instinct to be useful all the time and to make our lives helpful for other people when sometimes living your life is enough. But I will say thank you for using your own heartbreak as a way to talk about what happens to us. I think anyone listening has been through this cycle, and to honor it with a scientific survey of what is happening to us makes it a pretty fascinating read, I have to say. I'm sorry that your life had to go up on a pyre in that way
yes,
for this book.
Me too. But I'm glad if you found it useful. That's definitely helpful to me. And it's part of the healing process, as I learned, right? That if you can make your story more universal and be vulnerable in a way that encourages other people to be vulnerable too.
Yeah.
It's helpful. The sense of purpose that it engenders in me is helpful. And hopefully it's helpful to other people too.
Yeah. Well, and we're meaning-making creatures, right? And so to actually use our lives to create a different story or to revise our story. But obviously, this isn't a book that you ever thought you would write. No one sets out to trace the arc of, I mean, you guys started dating in college, right?
Yeah, we started, well, I met him my first day of college. So I was 18, day one. We started dating about 3 weeks later.
And then you find yourself with kids and the end of a marriage unexpectedly. I mean, you do a beautiful job of sort of describing what I think many of us would witness. And I will say too, like, I'm not heartbroken currently, and hopefully, my marriage is intact and strong and hopefully durable, but we never know, right? This is all around us, sort of like
right.
a sea
know.
Of wreckage. Yeah.
Right.
Where you're like, I didn't, as you were writing about that too, sort of like the revelation to people who were shocked.
Yeah. I mean, I think we were very happy. I think we had a very good marriage for a long time, but you know, it was 32 years long by the time, you know, including the dating. That's three decades of life. Things change, you know, things happen.
And yet heartbreak, you write about it. I love this at the beginning where you say, having never been heartbroken before, I tended to dismiss portrayals of it in popular culture, literature, even by my friends, I'm sorry to say, as overwrought. But one of the first stages of heartbreak, I soon learned, is feeling stunned, even if you shouldn't have been. I've been used to feeling in control, but you can't game heartbreak. And can you talk a little bit about that, sort of this, the course that you go through over the book of, does it follow any, it's not like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of acceptance, even though she later said, you know, grief is not a stage process and it's not tidy. Is there in your work, and I was looking for it, and I feel like you didn't make it, Pat, right? Like there is no core journey.
I did write the book to follow a loose chronology of heartbreak. I wouldn't say everyone's heartbreak is going to fit into that, but it was kind of the order of my heartbreak. So I start with this state of shock, you know, that really has a dramatic effect on one's body. I guess for me, you know, I had like the symptoms of shock, and that is partly what inspired me and surprised me and freaked me out, you know, that I could feel the heartbreak so intensely in my body. So I start out talking about shock, and then I move into grief and loneliness, and then, you know, the things that I tried to do to feel better, you know, with kind of science weaving its way in through all these threads, you know, and then finally, you know, some kind of resolution, not necessarily a tidy Hollywood ending, but resolution as it kind of really is in real life, which isn't always a tidy bow.
Yeah, we love those stories, and it's so tempting to wrap it up. And I feel like there was a thread of anger. I'm just thinking of the grieving stage. Did you have to burn through your rage in order to access your grief?
I think, you know, for me, the predominant emotions were anxiety and grief. The anger came a little bit later. It actually took me a while to kind of really own the anger and feel it. And I felt like that was a necessary stage in order to get to a more healing stage. But I was definitely able to feel a lot of anxiety and grief before the anger came, interestingly.
That is interesting. It's not surprising. I mean, I feel like anger can be instinctive and defensive in a way, and a protection, in my experience, sort of like the ice on top of the lake of grief, and you have to go into the anger in order to access the sadness. But I can also imagine it the other way, particularly because women are acculturated to be more comfortable with sadness than with our anger, that you have to sort of get to the anger.
Yeah, that could be.
Yeah.
You know, I was so still caught up in these complicated feelings that involved love, right, of my departing spouse. And I think I was in some ways projecting the anger onto other parts of my life before I was able to really project it onto him.
Mm-hmm.
But that was necessary. It was necessary to be able to do that. I did feel rage and anger about the state of women in general as I was going through this process. I mean, I was very aware of kind of the inequities, you know, of the law, the inequities of divorce as a process, how it so inequitably affects men and women, you know, on everything from, you know, the division of property to how your friends and peers kind of view you. They permeate everything from, I think, how your community views you differently in the breakup to the division of property and who ends up with more resources after divorce. And then to even dating, right? You know, that's the next stage. If you want to get back into the game as a middle-aged woman, you are so much more handicapped than your middle-aged husband. And I was, you know, just extremely aware of that. Plus, I had come from a legacy of divorce myself, and I had seen it, you know, in my own family. I had seen it in my friends' families. The women are the ones who really get the short end of the stick often after divorce, certainly economically, but also I think just culturally and socially as well.
Wondering what to give your mom or wife or daughter or friend or godmother for Mother's Day? From someone who cares a lot about her bed and sleep, may I recommend something from Cozy Earth? In fact, becoming a mom and suffering through its required sleep deprivation is where my obsession with sleep started. So it's one of those gifts that might really bring things full circle. After all, women in particular are really impacted by sleep deprivation, which has massive implications for our health. Between the hypervigilance of motherhood and the hot flashes of perimenopause and menopause, we get a raw sleep deal. So let me tell you about giving women you love their best night's sleep ever. Let me tell you about Cozy Earth. Their sheets are made from viscose from bamboo, and they are indescribably soft. So soft, like a bed hug, like no other. Now, I'm not the only mega Cozy Earth fan. Every single year since 2018, Cozy Earth products have been named as one of Oprah's favorite things. Oprah picked their best-selling bamboo sheet set because they're temperature regulating and incredibly soft, and she picked their joggers and their socks and their pajamas. Meanwhile, Cozy Earth doesn't just make sheets, they also make pillows, blankets, and more. Cozy Earth makes their products by sourcing responsibly. They use the best suppliers with an eye toward quality, responsible production, cutting-edge technology, and premium materials. They're also incredibly durable. They get better with every wear, and they have an enhanced weave that is guaranteed not to pill even after washing and drying. All Cozy Earth products can be returned or exchanged within 100 days and include an additional 10-year warranty against defects. This Mother's Day, treat mom to the luxury she deserves with Cozy Earth bedding and sleepwear, and prioritize her self-care and sleep health. She deserves it. Don't forget to use my promo code THREAD at checkout for 35% off at CozyEarth.com. After placing your order, select podcast in the survey and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows so they know that we sent you. And how did that show up in your life? I mean, we're all aware of the tropes of, you know, older men dating younger women, et cetera.
That.
But within your friend group, you know, was it that Was there just an aversion towards like wanting to be around anything that felt messy or sticky? Or did you feel like people were actively taking sides, or were they not taking sides and that was sort of the problem?
You know, I think there were a lot of different responses. I, my close friends were very supportive and right in there with me, and, you know, bless them because I really needed them and I needed their support. And that was terrific. But I think in kind of my looser ties, you know, sort of my broader social group, there was definitely this sense of, you know, I am maybe contaminating, you know, there may be something contagious about divorce. You don't want to necessarily be too close to it. And then I think there's this weird dynamic that you know, my divorced women friends and I talk about, of your couple friends don't really want to have you over, you know, at the dinner party because you're sort of the one single person. It kind of messes up their feng shui of their social event in some ways that I haven't really fully plumbed. I haven't really fully figured this out. Is it that as a single woman, you know, you're sort of threatening because now you're kind of available in a way? Or is it just that there's this unevenness, you know, of gender? I don't know. I'm not really sure what it's all about. But the weird thing is that, you know, when I was married and having dinner parties, I also tended to invite couples. It was kind of an unconscious thing. I didn't really think about it until I was the one who wasn't really getting invited to the dinner parties.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating and I'm sure incredibly painful. And as with all of these things, and what so much of the book is like tracing these threads of sort of our natural innate response to what happens when you lose connection or are pushed out of the circle, or sort of the need for connection that drives us versus the culture, and distinguishing between the two, right? The way that we, our lack of reverence for older women, our fear, yes, of women who are aging, even that the threat of like, is my partner going to suddenly decide, oh, divorce looks good on her, she's available, I'll leave my, whatever it is that lives in us. And then figuring out from that, yes, what is who we are versus like the culture that's driving these narratives.
And by the way, I think it's not just true for divorced women who are treated that way, but also widows, you know, they, yeah, also don't get invited, you know, to the dinner parties. There's also something contagious about them, I think, that, you know, it just magnifies the isolation and the loneliness and the grief of this experience. And I think it's really unfortunate.
And this idea of, you know, and I think as someone who was single through most of my 20s, the sort of lingering odor or this like, what's wrong with her? There must be something wrong with her. Like there is something that's being rejected. And the way that we assign that defectiveness to women, yes, and not to men is such a bad cultural hangover. Do you know the roots of that?
I don't, but I think it extends beyond that to a kind of defensive posture on the part of those who are married, who don't necessarily want to be reminded that marriage is problematic too. You know, and
what are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like anything, you know, it's like how judgmental we are of each other's parenting, you know, all these, yeah, kinds of things. We don't necessarily want to hang out with people who are doing it differently because there's this assumed critique, right, then, mm-hmm, of the way we're doing it. And I think that's very much true in this realm of divorce and marriage. And I mean, long-term relationships, look, they're really tough, right? Even when they're good, they're really tough. We all know it. But I know as someone who was in a marriage for 25 years that you don't really want to go there. You don't want to necessarily acknowledge that. It's, you're, yeah, putting your head down, you're doing the best you can, and you don't really want to entertain the possibility that this could end at any moment because that's so destabilizing. It's much easier just to keep going and not, yeah, think about it too much.
And the reality is, and I'm sure this was your experience for 25 years, and I've been married for 12 years, something like that. So I'm a bit behind you. But as in any relationship, it has its fallow periods and its really rich remunerative periods. And there are certainly, yes, times where you're like, this is kind of an emotional wasteland, like where you're doing too much parallel play and everyone's busy and then when you come back together, you know, for my husband and I, we'll like go to away for a weekend to a wedding and we're like, oh my God, we love each other. This is so fun. But there is an assumption baked into it that like a marriage is durable and can withstand a fair amount, particularly when you have young children. And so I think it is like incredibly destabilizing to recognize, oh, there's like a bridge too far. There comes a moment that's imperceptible where you're like, how am I on the other side of the door?
And I think what's also really destabilizing about that is that it's often unevenly felt, right?
Yes.
Like I kind of knew, yes, we were in this period of disconnection, right? As we had been in before, as all relationships go through. And I kind of thought, yeah, of course we'll come back together and it'll be fine. And he didn't. He was like, for him, it was the bridge too far. It was like, actually, I'd rather be connected to somebody else. Thanks. Bye. And so, you know, it's not always evenly felt.
No, there's, I'm looking for this passage where you write, this actually felt like a moment to me where you really get in touch with your anger. And I want to say that it was after you get off the river because you have this river trip that's very sort of wild, like where you're on a river by yourself. Which I love rafting, but I like rafting with other people, Florence.
Yeah, you were good idea, Elise. That's fun. I don't know why
not
that
like Vipassana on a boat with a toilet in the back, which I know you ditch. But you talk. Do you know this moment? I know it's been a minute since you wrote your own book, but it's such a beautiful moment where you don't delineate what he did. When you started enumerating the inequity in your relationship too, I mean, I know he said like very painfully, I'm going to go find my soulmate. Did you feel like he was your soulmate, or do you feel like you haven't met your soulmate yet? Or do you even believe in that as a concept?
Wow. I think I used to believe in it as a concept. And I think I thought we were, you know, our souls were joined, right? That there was this shared destiny that we had. I don't know if I would have used the term soulmate necessarily. Right. It's not my kind of term. It's definitely his kind of term. Good question. I don't think I really believe in the concept of soulmates now. I do believe in love. I think love of lots of different varieties, you know, familial love, community love, landscape, nature love. I believe all of these are so much a part of being human and being optimistic and living well. But this like long-term relationship, like you're going to have a soulmate for 60 years. I struggle with that one.
No, I get it. But I also struggle with the way that our culture thinks about, because you could say, well, we did 25, 30 years together. We had two amazing children. And I love how you write about sort of the family, the long-legged, how do you describe them? Sort of this like the kids that you have and the way that too, divorce like makes it so difficult, and particularly the way that we look at it and the pain that it obviously causes, but it makes it impossible to integrate in some ways, like a lot of your life, right? Like, what do you do with that black box of too painful to the touch memories? Or after a certain point, are you able to sort of go back there where you're not cutting people out of picture frames?
Yeah, I think I am more able to go back there now. I think there is this sort of radioactive quality to those memories for a while. And I think that's sad because, you know, a lot of those memories really are happy on their own. And it's too bad that they get sort of poisoned, you know, for a while. But I'm happy to say I do think I am, they're less radioactive now. And I do feel like I'm better able to integrate them, better able to understand that some of those feelings are going to stay complicated and they're going to be emotions layered on top of each other. But I can look at a photograph and be like, oh yeah, that was a sweet time. And also be like, God damn it. It sort of went south. But now, you know, I'm just at the point now where I have, I think, fewer regrets, honestly, about the divorce. I think I do feel like I've kind of integrated the pain of that enough to know maybe it was for the best, actually. And I value so much the growth and self-discovery, even though it was pretty sucky to go through it. Having come out the other side, I am a different person.
I'm
in
sure.
ways that I value, you know?
Well, I want to talk about that. I want you to read this section to us because I thought it was so beautiful. And this moment, which I think we can all recognize, is so painful and difficult when you have to say goodbye. I think anyone can tap into that moment when you are actually shutting the door on a relationship, revivifying, or even just like staying emotionally or mentally connected to someone, even when it's painful. And so it felt... Right. I think you were on the river or just off the river near the end of the book when you seemed to have this like completing moment. So if you could read this to us, I would love it.
Okay, sure. I found myself resisting saying goodbye to the marriage, to him, to the life I'd enjoyed. I opened a notebook. I made a list of all the things I loved about him. And then I wrote down all the things I didn't love about him. What I admired, his apparent ease, his sunniness, his competence, his enthusiasm for adventure. I loved our family unit, that these tall, kind, lanky humans were all my people. And I loved the happy delusion, such a delusion, that we were surrounded by a special force field of safety and fine weather. What I didn't admire, I won't enumerate his failings here, except to say the biggest one, the one I didn't miss at all, was his ability to make me feel that I wasn't quite worthy of him. That was bad enough, but the bigger problem was that I had started believing it. But the bigger problem was that I had started believing it. And as long as I still believed it, the worse my life looked alone.
It's beautiful, Florence. And in that moment, in that revelation, was that a new revelation or something that you knew had been sort of playing with or eyeing or trying to get your arms around? And like, was there a sense of closure where you in that moment chose yourself?
I think all of the above. I think there was this quiet understanding for a long time that I felt judged by him, you know, and I didn't like that feeling, hadn't liked it for a long time. But when I really articulated it in that way, that I was also judging myself kind of through his eyes and how just damaging, you know, that is. I think understanding that and being like, you know what? It's okay to not be perfect. I don't want to be judging myself for my imperfections. I actually want to be accepting myself for my imperfections. And that was really liberating, actually. You know, I think so many women, we grow up thinking we are supposed to be perfect. And we internalize, you know, excelling at everything and being good at everything and, you know, curating our appearance and, you know, being the perfect mom and doing everything right and doing everything right and doing everything right. And just the realization that I was like so over that and feeling like it was actually getting in the way of my having a more authentic understanding of who I was. That's when I think a corner really started to be turned.
And this idea too, I mean, this is what my whole book is about, but in this hunt for goodness and this quest to be good and to be ordained as good, it's not enough. We're never going to get that reassurance from or validation from an external world that we're safe and secure. It's only something that we can give to ourselves.
That's right. But I do think it's possible to find a partner who is able to love your flaws and accept you for who you are and kind of support an investigation, you know, into those characteristics, you know, who's willing to kind of take a journey with you. And my ex just so was not interested in that.
Right. And do you recognize that as just a quality of who he is or something that you guys didn't cultivate together?
I think he definitely grew up in a very patriarchal kind of WASPy culture where you don't air your flaws, like you just don't acknowledge them. So I think it's very much about his culture and frankly, the American culture overall. I mean, it's not just the WASPy male culture, but I think that certainly embraces that. So yeah, I don't think he'd go there with anyone. And I think a lot of men wouldn't.
Yeah. Do you not to linger on sort of like his emotional state, but I always, and watching other friends go through divorce, I'm always conscious of like the one that's doing the work and the one that's prolonging the work,
yeah,
and or
yeah,
like
totally.
Jumping from lily pad to lily pad, where I'm like, that swamp is waiting for you, friend. Right. Like, you can get in it now and
good luck.
Or you can, I guess, do it when you're 80. And it's sort of not that consoling. But when I was younger and, you know, friends would be going through these hard breakups and the guy would seem to sort of like skitter scatter away and like into another thing, it was like, just wait. He'll be broken on your doorstep in a year or two or whenever it is that he has to resolve the end of this relationship. Like, you can't procrastinate and push this stuff. It does get you, I think.
I think so. I do think there are some members of our society who seem to be a little more sheltered from deep examination, you know, unfortunately. I mean, that's what privilege does, right? It's kind of famously insulating.
It is famously insulating. But I think you can only outrun these things always for so long. And they have a real impact. I mean, that was what was so interesting about the book, the way that you traced, you know, the physical impacts of divorce, the way it showed up in your body in essentially unintentional and prolonged weight loss, weakness, you know, just the way it just destroyed you. I think we can all relate to that. I tend to be someone who stops eating as well in grief. Some people have the opposite experience, but that we have these massive physiological impacts that can be studied, right? I mean, you were doing your blood work, which I loved throughout. Have you done any more? Like, can you talk a little bit about what that showed?
Yeah, sure. I was really lucky early on in this kind of divorce recovery process to make contact with a wonderful scientist at UCLA, Steve Cole, who's an immunogeneticist, and he's made a career by basically studying the effects of loneliness on people's immune systems. And he does this by looking at a suite of genetic markers, transcription factors in our white blood cells. And these are markers that are tied to inflammation, tied to chronic disease. And we know that we've known for a long time that people who consider themselves lonely have a higher rate of chronic disease, they have a higher rate of early death, they have a higher rate of dementia, you know, all kinds of, you know, unfortunate outcomes, really, given the fact that not only are they lonely, but now they're also sicker than most people who are not lonely. So we decided that we would test my blood cells at different time points after the divorce. And I was trying all these interventions, you know, to feel better, to get healthier. I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, you know, not long after the split. I was worried that I was going to get sicker. You know, so I felt this kind of urgency to figure this out and to try to feel better as soon as possible. So, you know, I was trying all these interventions, such as the wilderness trip you mentioned, a number of other things. And we tested my blood before and after the wilderness trip. We tested it, you know, at various other time points. And it was really interesting because as someone who had written about the tremendous mental and physical health benefits of nature, you know, I was very invested in that as a curative. I thought, okay, I'm going to go on this like month-long wilderness trip and I'm just going to be so much better at the end of it. It's really going to cure me. And unfortunately, you know, my blood showed, not so fast. Actually, you're the same as you were before the trip. Even though I felt like I had made a lot of progress, you know, kind of cognitively, I had reflected and learned to meditate and done some interesting work. I was also still feeling kind of threatened and anxious because I was alone in the wilderness, right? Which is not how humans are supposed to feel relaxed and safe.
No, you picked something quite extreme.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the main theme here is that a heartbreak like this, when we feel like we've been abandoned, when we feel like we have lost, you know, a major support figure in our lives, our nervous system notices that and it responds by going into a state of threat. And so that's why people get sick, you know, after someone dies, after a divorce, when they feel lonely, it's because they feel threatened, you know, on some deep level. Like, you may think, of course, you know, there's no grizzly bear about to jump on me, but your nervous system, you know, doesn't really perceive it in a rational way.
I'm exceedingly careful about what I buy, not only because I live in a 1,500 square foot house with children who sure have an awful lot of stuff, but also because I try to be conscious about everything I use. In short, I want to use everything I buy. In addition, thanks to a decade in the wellness industry, I am very keyed into product claims and product content. This is why I like Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus Multivitamin, which is clinically backed with high-quality, traceable key ingredients in clean, bioavailable forms. I also like their Symbiotic Plus 2, which is a probiotic that's simple and effective. Ritual makes the most elegant multivitamin around. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus has everything you need, specifically 9 key nutrients in 2 capsules per day. Their unique Belitin oil is so slick it's actually patented, and their capsule has a delayed release design, which is brilliant and essential, to help make it gentle on an empty stomach. And Ritual studies their vitamins, which is not the standard in the industry. Ritual conducted a university-led clinical trial for their Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin to assess its efficacy. The results? It increased vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in just 12 weeks. As most of us are getting far less sun right now, vitamin D supplementation is essential. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus is one of the few women's multis that's USP verified, meaning what's on the label is what's in the formula. Only about 1% of supplement brands on the market have the USP verified mark. It's also soy-free, gluten-free, vegan-friendly, and formulated without GMOs. Did I also mention that Ritual is a certified B Corp and female-founded? Nothing makes me happier than these two facts. No more shady business. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus is a multivitamin you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month at ritual.com/thread. Start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18 Plus to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/thread for 25% off. In light of everything that you did, and I loved the way that you described your, did you do MDMA and mushrooms? Like some, yes. your trip, yes. And that your therapist was gently snoring. I mean, that was amazing. She slept through your experience.
My guide was asleep, yeah.
Asleep at the wheel. But what do you think, when you look at this experience, what do you think has been, and not to say that you're, you know, healed and be over it and beyond, whatever, we're so obsessed with that theme too, but what ultimately do you think was the most healing? Was it time? Mm. Was mm-hmm. it actually studying yourself and creating a story and revising that story? What do you think has been the most healing thing?
I think time was a huge part of it. And I think time for most people is a great curative, mm-hmm. not for everybody. And I did not want it to take the time. You know, it's, we know from studies that it takes on average 4 years for people's bodies to return to baseline, for their health to return to baseline after divorce. Mm. I felt like I wanted to speed that up as much as I could, if it was possible to. And I think all the things I did helped a little bit. I actually think the thing that helped the most in retrospect really probably was that session of psychedelics. And I'll tell you why. I think it's because it really addressed my fear, my state of anxiety. I was very afraid of growing old alone, you know, of kind of not having a partner to, you know, look out for me, of being financially insecure. I mean, I just had been with someone since I was 18. I'd never lived alone. And I had witnessed my mother dying alone and broke, and other women in my lives. And other women in my life whose partners had left them as well. And so we know actually from the research looking at psychedelics and people who are diagnosed with a terminal illness, for example, that it's just these amazing, interesting things happen in their brains where suddenly they don't feel so afraid. And I think that's really what happened to me. I was like, you know what? What happens, happens. It's all going to be okay. And I can't, it's not really a rational, it's hard to explain, but having such a mystical experience and feeling like I am part of this beautiful universe, we're all part of it together. You know, so many people struggle comes and goes. Everything is transient. I don't know. It was like this very kind of mystical reassurance in these bigger truths of the universe that were so much bigger than just like, I'm alone.
And I thought, I feel like it was like the tree and the vine, the way that you started to recognize the way that you were entangled with your husband and sort of how to start disconnecting and letting that, getting that not off you, but kind of, right? Like, yeah. Particularly you guys had grown up together. Yeah, I thought that was like a very beautifully described, because we can all, you know, you want that sort of codependence, that like commingled root system. And then at a certain point, like you saw him as like a strangler vine, right? Essentially.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, we basically grew up together and we became very integrated, I think, in each other's souls and in each other's hearts. And so I had this very clear vision while I was taking the psilocybin that I was a tree and that he was so tightly wrapped around my trunk that I couldn't grow. Mm-hmm. You know, I was too cathected, was the psychotherapy term. I was too bound to him kind of emotionally that I couldn't grow. And so I had this vision of like literally peeling this vine, strangler vine, away from my trunk. At which point, you know, the canopy of my tree was able to kind of grow into the light. And it was this very beautiful image that I think had a tremendous kind of emotional impact on me, where I was like, okay, goodbye. I need to grow now. Mm-hmm. And it just filled me with, I guess, a kind of sense of optimism, the sense that there was beauty ahead of me and that I could find some and that, yeah, I wanted to find it.
I love that too, because as you know, as we've sort of covered in this conversation, the cultural stigma attached to divorced women, in particular middle-aged women who are alone. And, you know, I love at the beginning when you encounter, I think it's Helen Fisher who's giving you, or another scientist at one of these events, who's giving you these like incredibly depressing statistics about sort of loneliness and its impact. And what is it like, it's like widowed, divorced, never married, married in terms of happiness? Or is it that an unhappy marriage actually trumps divorce?
It was actually very clearly looking at mortality. So it was a pretty like definitive outcome. Like, who's more likely to die young? And people who are divorced like come out at the very end. You know, people who've been single their whole lives have kind of figured out how to do that and be happy and have a support system, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. People who are divorced, sometimes there's a subset of people who are divorced who really don't recover, about 10 to 15%. They go on to have these health effects, and that's what's kind of skewing the stats. Mm-hmm. So I did not want to be one of those 10 to 15%. And I don't think anyone should be. And that's, you know, part of what motivated me to write this book. I mean, I really feel like if there's anything you can do to get out of the funk, you know, and despair of this kind of grief, you've got to do it.
No, and it makes a lot of sense. It's hard. It's also a hard narrative. It's similar to, I think they call it complicated grief now.
Yes, yes.
And which people understandably were really upset at even the suggestion that you could pathologize grief after death. And I 100% understand that. But they're talking about a very specific subset of people, typically who were depressed, I think, before the event, who can't even sort of like enter a room in the house that has any memento of the person who, they're so completely unable to function that it does become pathological. And the goal is getting people sort of re-engaged with life so they can actually even grieve. And I can imagine, I know people who get into sort of a divorce rut where it is like running their emotional lives, and it's a certain stuckness, right?
It's a total stuckness. And you know, we sometimes tend to internalize these stories that we have been told, or the stories from our childhood, or, you know, and it basically has to do with, we're not worthy, you know, these stories of we're not worthy, whether it started in childhood or whether it started through a kind of rejection, romantic rejection. You just don't want that story to keep being the story of your life. It's time for a new story.
And it's funny too, how, you know, we have an aversion for loss, obviously, culturally. But when you think about it, these are the opportunities. This sort of level of suffering is when we do grow and when we do get better. It's hard to do the work when there's no real, there's no emotional work to do, if that makes sense. And it sounds perverse, right. But we all recognize this, that what drives us deeper into ourselves allows us to emerge as a more expanded version. And, you know, I think about my 20s when, unlike you, I was sort of getting tossed around in the dryer by getting done, you know, all the things. And there, I do have a fair amount of gratitude for that now. Whereas I can imagine having, if I had married my high school boyfriend and had no experience of this too, like how unmooring it would be when it's so high stakes, you know?
Right. Like you probably got inoculated a little bit earlier.
A little.
I never had that inoculation. And I never had thought of myself as, you know, having trauma before.
Yeah.
And once I kind of took that on, then I learned about, you know, this other concept of post-traumatic growth. And it was such a lifeline to know that, even though I couldn't necessarily predict it or see it, just to know that there was something I could swim toward, that there is a very powerful, wonderful, beautiful kind of growth that can happen, you know, after we have been ripped down to our studs. It's really worth bending your brain to try to get there, you know?
Yeah.
It's worth the work.
Yeah. I loved the discussion in the book too about this idea of betrayal, and both emotional betrayal, sexual betrayal. You detail an experience with a guy that's wild, but I know that there's like a sense of betrayal in the devastation of your marriage too, right? Where you're sort of blind, this idea of feeling blindsided, or somehow like, how did I not know that? How were we not living the same reality, right? And betrayal to me is like one of those fascinating words, because we all know what it is. And then the second definition is like the revealing of something hidden. And sometimes that hidden thing is something that we're aware of. We don't want to acknowledge, right? We're like, just don't make this something that I actually have to deal with. Like, I would much rather pretend like this isn't happening. But it is in that way. It can be a betrayal of self. But how did you, and I thought it was really interesting, the conversation about like emotional betrayal versus sexual betrayal, because those two things are also so present in our culture, right? Like there's the act where it's in some ways like, oh, that's, I can understand. There was a moment of physical transgression, but for so many people, it's emotional, right? It's an imperceptible, nebulous, like, whoa, what's happening here? Which I think there's a gender difference in it, right? In the way that's experienced.
Yeah. I mean, there are psychologists who are looking at this kind of from an evolutionary perspective. And I kind of take everything they find with a grain of salt, because I've just learned that a lot of people who are looking at evolutionary biology, you know, have so much bias attached to it. But, you know, some studies have supported the idea that men take sexual betrayal more seriously, you know, and that's because their genes and the passing along of their genes really depends on sexual fidelity, right? They don't know if a kid is theirs. Whereas women, there's some indication that women take an emotional betrayal more seriously. And that's because they really need to know that they're going to have kind of the loyalty and support, you know, of a male figure. You know, who knows? I feel like
you take that with a grain of salt, though.
Yeah,
because
totally.
I also feel like you can't separate nature and culture. And
right. That's right.
There are these tropes, right, that we're all supposed to follow.
And I also feel like rejection is rejection. And as human animals, you know, if you want to talk about the evolution of it, you know, what is true is that we are a hypersocial species. We live in a very hierarchical society. We live in groups, typically. And if you get cast out, if you get sort of demoted in the hierarchy of your group, that has like life and death consequences for individuals. And so we are hypersensitive to social slights, including maybe especially romantic rejection, but about other kinds of rejection as well. So I think, you know, it's almost irrelevant whether it's sexual or emotional. And I think, you know, you hear people I think sometimes excusing their behavior is like, oh, well, I didn't sleep with her, so it's fine. It doesn't work that way in our brains. You know, it's just very deeply felt.
Pulling the Thread is sponsored by BetterHelp. Sometimes Max, my oldest, tells me he wants to go in the back of the house and talk. What he means by this is purely the verb. He doesn't want to have a conversation. He wants to talk, to vent and unload, to fill me with factoids. Mom, want to know 40 things about acid rain? But more often, to get things off his chest. It's fascinating to listen to him and what he perceives to be injustices, annoyances, and harms. I recognize that in those moments, he doesn't want advice or for me to higher mind him or for me to justify his own feelings to him, but simply to be a container for the one-sided stream, to just listen. I recognize what he's doing because I do it every week too, in therapy. I was thinking just the other week that it's rare to find someone who will just listen, maybe point out some patterns or hold me accountable when I say something wild. Wait, Elise, pause. Do you really feel that about yourself? Or why do you think you care about this so much? But aside from these moments of intervention when my therapist makes me reflect or feel, I'm doing the talking, and it helps me feel so much freer. Thank God for therapy. This is one of the reasons I'm very excited for therapeutic solutions like BetterHelp. They have licensed therapists who are available worldwide and specialize in depression, anxiety, sleep disturbances, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBTQA issues, grief, and self-esteem. BetterHelp is online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with the therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/PTT today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/PTT. I think for a lot of women, and again, I think this, there's a question here whether this is a natural instinct or just a cultural bias, but the idea of like your partner having an emotional relationship with someone rather than just like a fling in Vegas is very, it hits very differently.
Yeah. I mean, what hurts, hurts, you know,
what hurts, hurts,
regardless of what the studies show. And rejection is, it's one of the most painful and complicating emotions that we have.
Yeah. What are you working on now?
I have become really interested still in the science of awe, which I talk a lot about in the book. I think it's a really surprising antidote to heartbreak, which we haven't really talked about. I mean, we talked about how the river trip didn't really work, but for me, experiencing beauty and sort of being more open to beauty and to awe has also been incredibly helpful. Again, it reminds us, I think, that we're part of this larger, beautiful universe. And maybe what happens to our egos on a particular day is not the most important thing in the world. I would love for more people to get that message, you know, that that by accessing beauty, however it is you do it, you know, whether it's through nature or whether it's through music or through art or, you know, through witnessing, you know, amazing people in your life who inspire you. I think these are the things that really make us feel like we belong, make us feel connected to each other, make us feel connected to a larger world. And I just, I hadn't heard that message. I hadn't heard, hey, looking for awe is the secret to recovering from loneliness. But it turns out it is. And so I hope we can spread that word a little more.
Why do you think, you know, I know Dacher Keltner, his book just came out.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm probably more like tuned to those radio stations, but so I'm aware of it. But why do you think that those concepts take so long to puncture people's awareness? Is it because it's like so quiet inherently and so personal?
Well, I think in terms of the sort of field of psychology, awe was not taken seriously as an emotion until very recently, really until Dacher Keltner and his colleagues started looking at it in the early 2000s. It just hadn't really been studied much before. I mean, there was, in general, there was a bias towards studying negative emotions, right? And then when positive psychology started studying the positive ones, awe was kind of left behind for a while. I do think it's a complicated emotion, so it's not always easy to study. I think that's one of the reasons. And then I actually think all this work that we're seeing now on psychedelics has really pushed the field.
Yeah.
Because there's a theory that awe is, in fact, the mechanism by which so many people are transforming. You know, it's the sort of mystical experience they're having within the psychedelic treatment that is driving this incredibly profound change. You know, one of the things about awe that I think is really interesting is that when we experience awe, you know, for example, imagine that you're looking at the Milky Way for the first time, which a lot of kids are because they grow up in cities and they don't see the Milky Way. And then, you know, suddenly they go to summer camp or on a Girl Scout trip or something. And I've actually been with Girl Scouts who are 12 years old and looking at the Milky Way for the first time. And, you know, it's incredible, right? The expression on their face changes. They suddenly feel like a grain of sand in the universe. They are they are so full of wonder and amazement that they're trying to sort of understand what it is. Oh, that's a galaxy. It's on its side.
Yeah.
There's this cognitive accommodation that we do when we are experiencing awe, in which our brain kind of stops its normal categorization of things. You know, oh, that's a tree. Oh, that's a rock. It's more like, oh my God, what is that? And in that moment, there's this incredible window of learning that can happen. So when you're experiencing awe, it's an opportunity for you to also reexamine who you are and what your place is in the universe. And I think that's why it's working in psychedelics. And it's also maybe why it worked for me. It's like this rare window to sort of reassess everything that you thought about the world.
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool.
It's amazing. And it's like also so fun to think about people like you with your science-y brain sort of opening a new line of inquiry or insight, you know, and it's because you think about sort of where we are at this moment in time. And I like went on a big, I don't know if you've ever read Ken Wilber, but a big Ken Wilber deep dive, and he's brilliant. And his whole thing is like taking paradigms and organizing paradigms. And this just like capacious, massive brain, like literally writing them down on yellow legal pad sheets and like putting them in his house for 4 years and like putting them all in systems. And like, it's his point is that in our like system of evolution, we have sort of the me, we, it's. And for a certain amount of time, the it and its has been so dominant as we've developed our scientific language and understanding of the world, and that we're lagging a little bit, or like bringing all of these things together, everyone's speaking a slightly different language. And his point is like, you can think about the brain and you can study the brain and look at all the synapses firing and all of the sort of neurochemistry that's there, but you will never know someone's mind until you talk to them. And you'll never have a sense of someone or their personality from studying the brain. But we've been so focused on sort of it's part of the quadrant that he delineates. And so the mystical, obviously, is the me-we. And so thinking about it as a really necessary part of our lives that has to be nourished, and it's like an extra part of context that we can forget about. But it's exciting to me to watch people like you, people like Dacher Keltner and the psychedelic movement and the people sort of ancillary to that, as they're bringing the mystical and the scientific together. I mean, I'm convinced it's all the same. It's different languages for the same thing, and that we'll get there. We're like building those bridges.
And I think we're really hungry for it. You know, we have an understanding that we're living this kind of awe deprived life in general right now. You know, we're not having enough daily exposure to the moon and the sunset and wild animals. You know, I mean, our species used to have this daily drip of awe. You know, life was not easy, but we were able to sort of recover from those stresses in lots of ways. And awe was one of them.
Yeah. And just the magic, like just the ineffable magic of our lives and the strangeness of our existence. And then to also constantly be like our tendency to like define that, describe it, like attribute it to various factors and just like drain the magic out instead of being like these things can be concurrent in us. And yes, I'm a human biological being having this very physical material experience, but then there's all this unseen, whether it's the Milky Way being hidden by light pollution or something else, like the something else is so weirdly reassuring.
Yes. And I think a lot of people just feel the absence of meaning. I mean, we're just living in an epidemic, right? Of loneliness and connection and grief and anxiety. I mean, all of these things.
Yeah.
I think people are sort of looking. They're looking for things that are going to bring that meaning back. And so, I mean, you know, and in some ways, like heartbreak and grief and talking about it and owning it and feeling it, and it's opening a lot of doors. So that gives me hope.
One of the things that Florence explores really beautifully and deftly in Heartbreak is this period of life. She's a little bit older than I am, but the 40s and 50s, and the way that so many women experience a massive transformation and shift, where really I think women become more themselves and come to be more to themselves as society chooses to sideline or make older women invisible. Although I do feel like there is growing resistance against this. We desperately need our wise women to be reinstated and rethroned. And she writes, "Ethnographer Howard Norman once told me about interviewing an Inuit woman who laid out her life story. He said to her, 'I see everything but the years from when you were 50 to 54. "Oh, I have no words for those years," she replied. "Why not?" "In those years," she told him, "I was a polar bear." "These are our polar bear years. Everything about us is changing physically, hormonally, emotionally. Our shifting roles and culture, work and family upend our identities, even without divorce. I told Barnes about my own reluctant transition and my desire to mark it, recover from it, figure out what the hell comes next. She convinced me of the importance of setting clear intentions for my solo self, and I found myself reviewing them during the quiet stretches on Dezo." Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. If you liked today's episode, please rate and review and tell a friend. You can find show notes and full transcripts of the episodes at EliseLunan.com. While there, please sign up for my Substack. I send a short note every Wednesday about topics that are aligned with this show and a deeper dive most Sundays. Or follow me on Instagram at EliseLunan. And finally, if you haven't already, please consider picking up a copy of my New York Times bestselling book, On Our Best Behavior, The 7 Deadly Sins and the Price Women Pay to Be Good, available wherever you get your books. It's an exploration of how women have been conditioned for goodness, men for power, and all the ways we've been programmed to police ourselves and each other according to these cultural ideas of what it is to be a good woman. I'd also like to give a huge thank you to my sponsors who make this show possible. Please support them the way they support this podcast. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studio. If you enjoyed this episode, please listen, rate, review, and follow Pulling the Thread. Available now for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give a shout out to Phil Svitek, Lauren LaGrasso, Mary Kate McDonough, Ali Brockman, and the entire Cadence 13 team for producing these episodes, and to Valero Duvall for my key art. Take care of yourselves. I'll see you next week.